From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, Attorney General John Ashcroft and FBI Director Robert Mueller unveiled the pictures of seven suspected al-Qaeda operatives to a packed news conference and gave us this terrifying news.
Credible intelligence from multiple sources indicates that al-Qaeda plans to attempt an attack on the United States in the next few months.
A year ago, this pronouncement might have sent the media into a tailspin of dire predictions, but not this time. One reason may be that the government itself sent a mixed message. Just hours before that news conference, Homeland Security Secretary Tom Ridge appeared on five TV networks telling the public to proceed with holiday plans and normal routines and that the terror alert level remains on yellow. But news outlets also are more skeptical. On Thursday, the New York Times ran a front-page teaser for a story on page A16 titled, "As Ashcroft Warns of Attack, Some Question Threat and Its Timing." High up in the story, it presents the suspicions of police and firefighter union leaders, supporters of John Kerry, that the warning was meant to distract attention from the president's poll numbers. It quotes an anonymous administration official as saying, quote, "There's no new intelligence. A lot of this has already been out there."
This is precisely the sort of tempered reporting some media critics wish had occurred in the run-up to war. And one of them, Slate's Jack Schaefer, has been calling for a correction ever since. On May 17th, his column had this message for the paper of record's executive editor. Note to Bill Keller. Colin Powell admits he was misled about WMD. Why can't the Times? On Wednesday, the New York Times did just that and ran an editor's note taking stock of, quote, "a number of instances of coverage that was not as rigorous as it should have been." In particular, it referred to an unquestioning reliance on Iraqi defectors such as Ahmed Chalabi as principal sources, often without verification or follow-up. Of the six articles used to illustrate the problem, four of them bore the byline of Judith Miller, though she wasn't mentioned by name in the note. Jack Schaefer has been calling for a re-examination of her work for more than a year. But now that it's come to pass, he sees no reason for singling her out.
The last time I checked, Judith Miller doesn't have the keys to the press room at the New York Times. She can't write a story and then go down in the basement and run off copies of it and send them into our homes. She's aided and abetted by editors, a whole team of very, very professional editors. Anybody who's worked in a newsroom can tell you that there is a game played between reporters and editors. Reporters, especially investigative reporters, like to push it as far as they can. And they're counting on the editor to be the cop and say, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, that's going way too far. You got to give me more information or we got to take that out." In the case of Judith Miller, the cops were asleep and they allowed her to publish stories that the Times now wishes that it could take back. So if you want to give Judith Miller a pink slip, then several editors should get theirs too.
We had Keller on right after he took the position of executive editor last July, and he said that he was proud of the fact that when the New York Times screwed up big, it owns up big. Do you think the current apology is enough to preserve the paper's credibility?
I'm describing the note as a mini culpa as opposed to a mea culpa. The New York Times is essentially saying mistakes were made. Here are some stories that don't meet the standards of the Times. And then there's a promise at the end of the column that says it is an unfinished story. We will get to the bottom of it. So rather than judge the Times on the editor's note, I think we need to judge the Times on what it's going to do now to correct the record.
And you expect that they'll issue a longer investigative piece like they did after the mess over the accused scientist Wenho Lee? And after the Jason Blair scandal, there was a long, famously long deconstruction of his stories. Do you expect that to happen again?
Will it do an omnibus story as it did with the Wenho Lee case? Maybe it will. As a reader, I would be satisfied if they just knuckled down and got to the bottom of how it was that they published so many faulty stories.
We spoke with Knight Ridder's Jonathan Landay in March about the consistent over-reliance on a small group of Iraqi defectors. And in his report, he noted that 108 news stories cited the defectors' information. To your knowledge, was the Times the worst offender?
I can't judge that because I didn't read the coverage of all the newspapers cited in Knight Ridder. What I can say is the New York Times is unique in American journalism in that it sets the news agenda for practically every other news organization in the country. I mean, let's also give the New York Times some credit here. I don't see this kind of mini culpa being issued by other news organizations, which also published accounts from the Iraqi defectors. I would put this question to you. Has NPR gone back and looked at its coverage to see if perhaps it published untrue stories in the run-up to the war?
Not to my knowledge. Back when we spoke to Washington Post reporter Dana Priest after the misreporting of the Jessica Lynch story, she basically said that that was the best they could do with the information right. they had.
I'm a big defender of a journalist's right to get it wrong. I mean, I'm paraphrasing Edgar Allan Poe here, but he once said something to the tune of, journalism is important because we can't wait for a PhD dissertation on what happened yesterday to inform us today. The truth needs some breathing space in order to come out, and that breathing space includes stories that are wrong or misguided or faulty. The important thing for journalists to do is go back and correct the record. In the case of the Washington Post, I think they did a pretty credible job of walking the dog back, finding out where the Jessica Lynch story went wrong, and reporting the truth.
Jack, let's look ahead. This appears to be a time when journalists say they're scrutinizing their own behavior and the way they gather the news. Is this going to make journalism better, do you think? Or is this a momentary blip in what has often been called a wall of implacable arrogance?
I think that newspapers are fallible institutions. If you go back and look at the reporting in Watergate, we remember that as journalism's finest hour. But in David Greenberg's recent book about Richard Nixon, he catalogs all the things that the press got wrong about Watergate. I think that what people need to understand is not to believe everything that they read in the newspaper, to read a variety of newspapers, listen to a variety of broadcasters, and figure out for themselves what the truth is.
Okay. Jack, thanks a lot.
Okay, thank you, guys.
Jack Schaefer writes the Press Box column for Slate. The Times note underscores the argument now raging over whether the coverage of Iraq has been too upbeat or so excessively biased that it actually hurts the war effort, as charged by conservatives and some in the military. This week, media critic and educator Jay Rosen wrote in his weblog PressThink that he objects to the very terms of that debate. It's not about quantifying the positive and the negative. It's about completeness, he says. The coverage is distorted because it's too narrow. Jay, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much.
So, Jay, I assume you're a voracious news consumer. What aren't you getting?
Any picture of how it's going in creating a democracy in Iraq, in rebuilding that country after the devastation of both Saddam and the war.
Can you give me some specifics of the stories you'd like to hear or read?
I want to know how much of the electricity is on, how much of the water is on, how many of the schools are open, how is life returning to normal or not, as well as the 400 political parties that I'm told now exist on the Iraqi landscape. Who knows about these parties? What do they have to say? What are they about? I just don't have that picture in between the battles and the government stories that we do need. Something has been left out.
And why do you think this is such a vital piece of the puzzle?
The rebuilding of Iraq is something that billions of American dollars are going to. Thousands of people are employed in it. Lots of those who are on the planes to Iraq are not involved in the violence at all. They're involved in this huge enterprise. And that enterprise deserves accountability journalism just as much as the political enterprise, the coalition, the government, the military.
What news do you consume on a daily basis? Where do you get it?
Well, I'm a regular reader of the New York Times and the Washington Post, semi-regular The Guardian UK. And then, of course, because of the web, I'm able to sample reporting and commentary all over the place. And I read about 10 to 12 weblogs a day. And then usually at night, I'm watching cable television for an hour or so.
Are you saying you can't find these stories in the Times or NPR? Or?
No, I'm not saying I can't find these stories. I'm saying the portrait overall has not provided, I think, a really good account of that. I think what you end up knowing if you pay attention to the news is actually a very good measure of what the news is about. I mean, do it yourself, people at home. If you close your eyes, what do you have a clear picture of? And what do you not have a clear picture of? And I know I have a clear picture of American soldiers going into battle and car bombs and explosions and the authorities making their announcements. And I don't have this sense. And I don't think any consumer of the news has a good sense of the rebuilding of Iraq, in which the American people are extremely invested.
Now, a lot of conservative media critics would agree with you because I think they would assume that's where a lot of the good news is. But don't reporters risk, you know, going with military guards to staged hospital openings or soccer games or Barbie distribution sites? And are these stories newsworthy?
Absolutely not. The only way to find out whether life is better in Iraq is to do independent, skeptical, even investigative reporting. But I also think that it might be good occasionally for the press to find something in what their critics are saying that makes sense. And I think the neglect of the rebuilding story is a piece of the rights critique of the media that is real. Why not take it?
We've spoken to reporters who say it's very difficult to safely venture out of the green zone, the part that's under the control of the Coalition Provisional Authority, without risking their lives. How do you suggest they go about getting the daily life story?
I think it's an enormously difficult story even before they were confined to the green zone. After all, it doesn't explode like a bomb. It's something that creeps along. Daily life doesn't have press conferences either. So it's a difficult story to tell. And if you're confined to your hotel, yeah, it's even harder. That's one reason why a network of sources of Iraqis, ordinary Iraqis, who somehow or another might be trained, deputized to provide information coming in, if a lot of work had gone into the development of that kind of a network, maybe all the press would be benefiting from it now.
You really feel that this story is possible to get if the resources were put towards it?
Absolutely. Out there, somebody knows this story. A lot of people do. And there are ways of getting it, but I don't think it's necessarily been seen as a problem or the important challenge that it should be. What I think is that journalists know that they should do this, but it's a sidebar. It's a feature. Okay, but it really isn't a feature. It's at the very heart of the American enterprise in Iraq right now. You know, the division of labor in American journalism is really funny sometimes, you know. If you look at the whole press, you'll find 90% of it trying to do the same thing, and then 10% of it perhaps off doing something different. So within the American press, there's certainly enough capital and resources and intelligence to do a really good job on this story.
Well, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Brooke.
Jay Rosen's weblog is pressthink.org, and he's the chairman of the journalism department at New York University.
Coming up, the resurgence of Congress as media anvil, the wavering stars and stripes, and fun with FOIA.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Last summer, several months into a violence-plagued occupation that many soldiers in Iraq had not expected, the military newspaper Stars and Stripes conducted a survey of troop morale. Half of the nearly 2,000 soldiers surveyed said morale in their units was low and they did not plan to reenlist. 40% described their training as insufficient, and almost as many said their missions were not clearly defined. The findings were printed in a multi-part series titled Ground Truth and seemed to be a harsh critique of war planners, especially considering the source, a Pentagon-funded daily hardly known for its muckraking. But an article in this month's Washington Monthly suggests it might have been even harsher. The magazine's Robert Schlesinger spoke to Stars and Stripes staffers on the condition of anonymity. They told him that stories that ran in the paper were sanitized versions of the stories they'd actually written.
The headline of the lead story was, "What is the morale of U.S. troops in Iraq? Answers vary." And in fact, all the reporters involved in the story signed a letter complaining that the stories had been watered down, that they had been, in many cases, just killed entirely. And the reporters, some even wanted to have their names taken off their stories.
Is there evidence that this rather severe denaturing of the series was the result of pressure from the Pentagon or elsewhere?
The evidence isn't so much that it was someone from the Pentagon saying ahead of time, you've got to quash this series, you've got to make it look good. More along the lines of editors worrying that if it ran as the reporters reported it out and wrote it, that it would bring a severe reaction from the Pentagon. And so they were sort of preemptively trying to water it down so that there wouldn't be this reaction.
I gather this is not the first time this issue of editorial independence has come up. Congress has been involved at various points, no?
Yes. There's a long, interesting history with Stars and Stripes in terms of this struggle between editorial independence and Pentagon control. It goes back to at least World War II, when Patton actually tried to ban some Stars and Stripes reporters from his theater of operations. But Eisenhower stepped in and said, no, Stars and Stripes has to be editorially independent because it's important for the morale of the troops to get straight news. And in the mid to late 1980s, the Congress had the General Accounting Office, its investigative arm, investigate complaints about censorship in the paper. And the GAO found that there was a great deal of censorship. And one great example was that in a story that Stars and Stripes ran that originally had quotes from Senator William Proxmire saying that there were issues of censorship with the paper, one of the editors took out the Proxmire quotes that talked about there being censorship and instead put in quotes from himself, from that editor, saying there was no censorship.
That's delicious in its crystalline perfection, is it not?
I mean, it's really quite brilliant. Congress, at that point, decided to restructure the paper. Initially, the editors, who up until then had been military officers, they were made civilian positions. And then in the mid-1990s, the publisher was made a civilian as well.
But at the same time as Congress was trying to mandate editorial independence, they were undermining that effort by making Stars and Stripes more dependent on the Pentagon for financing. How did that play out?
The paper was able to sustain itself by, they ran a series of bookstores in U.S. military bases abroad. They needed these bookstores to keep them in the black, as it were. In the early 90s, the Congress started getting complaints that the bookstores were run inefficiently, and they gave control of the bookstores to the Army and Air Force Exchange Services. So in order to make up the money that the paper was losing, they said that the Pentagon had to pay for roughly a third of its budget, which at this point is about $12 million.
Well, there's this weird opposing mirrors aspect of all of this. The Pentagon funding a newspaper which does reporting, which finds morale low among U.S. troops, which bounces back to the Pentagon, which dismisses it as inaccurate reporting. It sounds to me like there can never be a resolution if the sponsor of journalism is also the subject of the journalism and doesn't like the journalism being done.
It is an inherently contradictory situation that eventually you do see repeated instances where the sponsor tries to change the tone. And another way of doing it, if not the kind of heavy-handed, don't run this story, which they have done, is the subtler, you know, we're very concerned about the cost of running this, and we're not going to help you out as much as we could. You kind of hollow out Stars and Stripes until it becomes something less than a robust, aggressive, independent newspaper.
Given all the overlapping conflicts of interest, and given the proliferation of other media that do distribute all around the world, including where U.S. forces are deployed, USA Today, International Herald Tribune, all kinds of satellite TV channels and so forth, is it possible that Stars and Stripes has simply outlived its usefulness and that the material contained therein is available elsewhere anyway?
I don't think so, because a lot of the stuff contained therein isn't available elsewhere anyway. I mean, this is a newspaper in many ways like a typical small-town newspaper, just that the town, instead of being Peoria, Illinois, is the U.S. military. It's a town not in the physical geographical sense, but in the kind of communal sense. And Stars and Stripes fits a niche that the International Herald Tribune, USA Today, don't and can't fit. And that's why I think they're still important.
All right. Well, Robert, thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much.
Reporter Robert Schlesinger's article, Stars and Stripes, appears in the current issue of Washington Monthly.
Meanwhile, in Washington, an acrimonious argument over continuing hearings on Iraqi prison abuse. The president and his congressional allies see it one way.
Under the dictator, prisons like Abu Ghraib were symbols of death and torture. That same prison became a symbol of disgraceful conduct by a few American troops who dishonored our country and disregarded our values.
Others in Congress claim the blame goes much higher, and they say that the half-dozen Pentagon inquiries now completed or ongoing won't reveal the truth because the Army cannot investigate itself. The Senate Armed Services Committee is eager to keep probing. House Republicans charge it with playing politics, and the reporting goes on, fueled by Congress. It's quite a change from last November, when investigative reporter Scott Armstrong told us that the coverage of the run-up to war had been overcautious because of congressional passivity. Congress, he said, is supposed to act as a kind of anvil, providing a platform for stories in which journalists can hammer out the truth. Without Congress, reporters had to initiate investigations and risk being charged with bias. In the nervous days post 9/11, it rarely happened.
What happens is when you don't have a public forum, when you don't have either a congressional committee, when you don't have that anvil, the media is insecure. It feels that it's not able to pin it down. It's looking for other people to take the responsibility. And so it writes it in a very namby-pamby way. Right now, we're swinging the media hammer, and it's just flying through the air. It's not hitting anything. The Congress isn't there.
So, Scott, 6 months and many congressional hearings later on 9/11 and Abu Ghraib, are we finally hearing the clanging of hammer-hitting anvil?
I think we're beginning to hear some clanking. These pictures have made it very difficult to ignore the issues that underlie them. So both sides, the media and the Congress, are beginning to ask questions.
And, of course, the anvil that started it off, I guess, was 60 Minutes, too, by offering those pictures to the public. Does that mean that the media finally functioned as anvil first and then the Congress assumed the role?
Well, between the probing of 60 Minutes, they're bringing it out to national attention, and the fact that one of the most aggressive investigative reporters in America, for that matter, in the world, Seymour Hersh, has been on this from the beginning, has made it pretty hard to ignore.
Well, let's talk about the Seymour Hersh factor. He's the famous investigative reporter who has been reporting on Abu Ghraib in The New Yorker. If the photos had been there, but Seymour Hersh's reporting hadn't been there, where do you think this investigation would be now?
Well, we'd be getting some questions posed by Congress, but I think they'd be accepting the answers that would be coming out of Secretary Rumsfeld, or have come out of Secretary Rumsfeld, Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz, and a variety of the military people. Remember that the report itself said that this was something that happened because of lack of supervision, poor command and control, but basically it was a few bad apples. And what Hersh has done is to say, it doesn't make any sense. A bunch of kids don't come up with methods to humiliate and torture people that are highly sophisticated psychological methods. What Hersh is saying is that this is a military intelligence, not a military prison problem. It's a story where Hersh has an editorial line, and it seems to be coming together pretty well.
So then, getting back to the process, the key to this symbiotic relationship between Congress and the media are investigative reporters who are willing to stick their necks out when most of the media outlets are waiting for Congress or some photos to appear?
Well, the investigative journalist is the one who really picks out that piece of metal that's going to be shaped by the hammer and the anvil. And he puts it in a way that the process of shaping it doesn't stop with just one or two raps. And that's why the reason this one is good is it starts with pictures about prison abuse, but it takes you into the heart of the intelligence community, what they were doing, what they were thinking.
Okay, so then thanks to Hersh and thanks to pictures, the anvil and hammer are working fast and furious on the Abu Ghraib story. But absent those particular elements, has Congress and the media continued to drop the ball on important stories?
Well, the underlying feature of this story is that the individuals involved that haven't been questioned, haven't answered questions, are involved also in the search for the weapons of mass destruction. They're involved in the question of how we're pursuing the war against terrorism. There's a little body of highly secretive organizations within the Pentagon, within the CIA, that are responsible for this, and we have not seen them have to face any scrutiny or any light. The press will nibble around the edges, but they will gradually begin to get pieces of it if Congress pursues it. No, I'm still skeptical as to whether or not the Congress and the mass media really have the willingness to pursue this to try and find out what's happened. There's still too many images that come up from 9/11. There are too many times when terrorism and the threat that Al-Qaeda is now in Iraq are used to try and damper the story. It's an awful lot to ask of the press, given the poor performance so far, to ask tough questions of the president. What did he know and when did he know it? There needs to be a lot of intermediate bridges that are going to be followed up. I'm not sure they're there.
So this clang and bang that you're hearing is a temporary condition brought about by some pictures and by investigative reporter Seymour Hersh, and you don't really see hope for a continuing trend, a kind of momentum.
No, I always have hope. That's what journalism is. Journalism is the reporting of information with the hope that somebody will actually use it. And when things change as a result of people's asking questions and demanding answers and not being satisfied with the answers that they're given that are the made-up answers long before, that are the go-away-and-leave-me-alone answers, once they probe beyond those, you really have something that's very interesting. That's how a democracy is supposed to function. And the press likes it. The Congress likes it. At least some of the Congress likes it. So there's some reason for optimism. It could work.
Scott, thank you so much.
And thank you, Brooke.
Scott Armstrong is a Washington journalist and founder of the National Security Archive.
The Freedom of Information Act, known as FOIA, can be a lean, mean fighting machine in the battle against excessive government secrecy. The FOIA request is not a difficult tool to wield. It takes just a little know-how and a lot of patience. Russ Kick knows the drill. Independently, he's filed hundreds of FOIA requests, and they have yielded some unforgettable results. You're probably familiar with his work. He filed the FOIA request that led to his receiving hundreds of pictures of military coffins returning from Iraq. In April, he made the photos available on his website and left every other journalist in the country dumbfounded. How did he do it? Well, he followed the instructions and filed a request. Russ Kick joins me from Tucson, Arizona, to tell us how it's done. Russ, welcome to On the Media.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
You filed hundreds of FOIA requests over the years.
Mm-hmm.
What's the longest you've had to wait before getting a satisfactory response?
Several of my requests, over a year later, I get the acknowledgement that, yeah, we're going to start working on this now. Usually, it's more in the matter of a few months is how long it takes to either get what I want or get the rejection.
The fact that it takes so long, I gather, is one of the reasons more reporters don't more routinely take advantage of this avenue of research.
This is something that truly anybody in the country or anybody in the world can do. All you have to do really is send a letter to the FOIA office of the agency that you're interested in and tell them what you want. You don't even need to be a citizen, actually.
Do you believe that FOIA is grossly underutilized by American media?
Oh, definitely. There's been studies that have been done about who is using the FOIA, and it turns out that the media makes up just a tiny fraction of all the requests. It was something along the lines of 10%.
Do you have any evidence to suggest that government agencies intentionally make the process as cumbersome and unrewarding as possible to discourage reporters who, after all, are on deadline from getting involved in the process to begin with?
Oh, definitely. If you remember the strategy game Othello, the slogan for that is a minute to learn, a lifetime to master. And that's pretty much the way it is with FOIA, because you can learn how to make a request in a minute, but dealing with the stonewalling, the excessive fees, and just sometimes outright lies, that's what takes a long time to learn how to work with.
Well, FOIA master, bestow on us your your wisdom.
Well, one thing is, under FOIA, you have one appeal when you're denied. Always use it, because there are these various numbered exemptions having to do with national security or personal privacy. They have to name specifically at least one of those. If they don't, which sometimes happens, then you've really got a great case for an appeal. But even if they do name them, you know, you try to think like a lawyer and figure out why they're wrong to have used that exemption. Most of the time I've found the appeals don't work, but it's still important to try. And another thing is, one of the tactics that the CIA is using, and they're one of the most popular agencies that get FOIAs, they'll automatically send you a letter back saying that you have to agree to pay at least $150 for each request before they'll even start processing. And the reason this is something of a trick is because they're hoping, of course, that most people will just say, well, forget it, you know, I can't afford that. The way I get around that is when I send any request into the CIA, I automatically tell them in the letter that, yes, I agree to pay up to $150 for this request. And so far, I've never had to pay near that much.
Okay, so let's say I want to find out who paid for President Bush's flight suit and his stunt where he landed on the aircraft carrier to declare the mission accomplished in Iraq. I put a letter in the mail to the FOIA administrator at the Department of Defense and say I'm willing to pay $150 for the information. Please send me the appropriate documentation. That's it?
Oh, that's pretty much it, yeah. The only thing is, when you write the letter, you have to say, you know, something along the lines of, this is a request under the Freedom of Information Act. And after that, just tell them what you want. It also helps if you tell them whether or not you're an independent researcher or a member of the media or something like that, just so that they can assess fees. And if you're a member of the media, it actually, all fees are supposed to be waived. You know, you don't have to tell them anything about why you want this material. And by law, they're not allowed to ask you that either.
All right, Russ. Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Russ Kick is an expert and heavy user of the Freedom of Information Act. His latest book is The Disinformation Book of Lists, published by the Disinformation Company.
Up next, reporters who ignored a leak face legal jeopardy just for listening. And America's number one man on the street.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities, on the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Last July, syndicated columnist Robert Novak printed a tip he says he obtained from two administration officials that Valerie Plame, wife of Ambassador Joseph Wilson, was a CIA operative. The tipsters broke the law when they supplied her name, but Novak won't reveal their names. Though Novak is the only one who ran with the scoop, it seems that those loose-lipped officials slipped her name to a handful of reporters. Now a federal grand jury has subpoenaed at least two reporters, NBC's Tim Russert, who says he never got the leak, and Time Magazine's Matthew Cooper. Neither of them ever named Valerie Plame, but they will fight the subpoenas because journalists, if they want to remain journalists, do not reveal their sources. Lucy Dalglish is the executive director of the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press. She joins me from Washington, D.C., and says that state shield laws that usually protect journalists offer little shelter in federal cases.
There are shield laws in about 34 states that make it very difficult for investigators to subpoena the media in those state court proceedings. On the federal level, we rely on a very complicated First Amendment privilege. And in the last couple of years, the federal courts have been much less likely to recognize that privilege than they have in the previous 30 years.
So Tim Russert and Matthew Cooper, a reporter for Time magazine, have been subpoenaed. What happens next?
What I think their employers will do is go to U.S. District Court here in Washington, D.C., and move to get the subpoenas quashed, that is, have them thrown out.
Now, the investigators were supposed to have exhausted all other possibilities before resorting to subpoenas to journalists. It seems to have happened pretty quickly, no?
We know that they had been having grand jury testimony from White House staffers over the last couple of months. And the law really does require them to exhaust those sources before they turn to the journalists. So I am a little bit surprised at how quickly it's come up. But when the big gun media like NBC and Time magazine are subpoenaed, they're going to pull out the checkbooks, pay the lawyers, and this can hold up that particular investigation till well past the election.
Now, NBC has said quite emphatically that Tim Russert is not a leaky to begin with. Is it clear to you why he is on the list?
No, it's really not. But perhaps they thought if they could go after a really big name in town and put pressure on him, maybe they could get other people lower down to come up with the information. But I don't think there's any way Mr. Russert is, number one, going to testify about the sources. And as NBC said, he doesn't know who they are.
Now, what about Novak himself? He could solve this problem in a heartbeat by simply revealing his source. Would you be pleased or displeased if Robert Novak were to tell investigators who his source was?
Well, assuming he made promises to his sources that he would not reveal them, and assuming that if he did reveal them, it made sources in this town much less likely to trust reporters, then I'd have to say I would be very displeased.
What about when a crime is being committed, and especially a crime by a sitting administration? At some point, doesn't the news of an elected government breaking the law for political reasons trump the sanctity of the shield laws or even the ethical canon against revealing sources?
You have to remember that particularly here in Washington, the media often operate on leaks, particularly when it comes to national security issues. And I think you could point to countless stories where great public good was done because information was leaked from government agencies. Journalists keep their ethical obligation not to reveal confidential sources. They value it just as much as doctors and lawyers and priests view their obligations to keep information confidential. And I would hate to have a situation where if Mr. Cooper from Time magazine is forced to reveal a source, you could make an argument that Mr. Cooper's career as a reporter in this town could be over.
Is there any evidence that the enormous cost of fighting these legal battles is having a chilling effect and that news organizations are more likely to cave in to the wishes of government than they were, let's say, 10 years ago?
Well, one thing I have noticed is a slight increase in the number of media organizations that are refusing to extend legal coverage to freelancers if they're subpoenaed.
If you are caught, we will disavow any knowledge of your actions.
Yeah, something like that.
All right, so now I want you to take off your advocacy hat and put on your clairvoyance hat and tell me what's going to happen in the Valerie Plame situation.
There probably are going to be more reporters subpoenaed. They will all get together with their lawyers and try to come up with some sort of a strategy. The case will kind of languish. People will be rattling their swords a little bit. The reporters are not going to identify the sources. And then I think the administration will turn around and say, you know, we had a shot at finding out who the leaker was, but shame on you, you big bad media. It's all because of you that we'll never find out who it was.
Sounds plausible, I'm sorry to say. Lucy, thanks very much.
You're very welcome. It's always a pleasure.
Lucy Douglas runs the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press.
This week, two new studies turned up the heat under an old argument. One by the Pew Research Center and the Project for Excellence in Journalism surveyed local and national news outlets across all media. The other, by the liberal media watchdog group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, focused exclusively on NPR. Okay, big study first. The Pew Center polled more than 500 news professionals and found that compared to 5 years ago, reporters are more worried that bottom-line concerns are eroding the quality of the news. They increasingly disagree with their own management, and they disagree with the public, too. For example, 40% of Americans feel that one has to believe in God to be moral. Only 10% of reporters do. But the headline news seems to be that more national journalists, about a third of those polled, now describe themselves as liberal. That's compared to about a fifth of the general population. But what does that mean? The study's authors suggest that the media are by and large more libertarian than liberal. Quote, more journalists said they think it is more important for people to be free to pursue their goals without government interference than it is for the government to ensure that no one is in need. Perhaps the most telling finding in the Pew study is the most obvious one. The vast majority of those polled, liberals included, utterly oppose injecting ideology into news reporting. When asked to name a conservative news outlet, a healthy majority named Fox. Asked for a liberal outlet, they were hard-pressed, though the New York Times took the lead with roughly 20%. By the way, the poster child of media liberalism, National Public Radio, clocked in at about 3%, wedged in between ABC and NBC and well below the Washington Post. And that brings us to the study by FAIR, which charges NPR with an increasingly right-wing tilt because Republicans outnumber Democrats on its airwaves by 61% to 38%. What are we to make of this? That NPR is bending over backwards to appease its critics? Maybe. Even NPR's ombudsman Jeffrey Dvorkin says the findings seem about right, though he takes issue with some of FAIR's labeling. For instance, it calls the Brookings Institution a centrist think tank, though many say it's liberal. Dvorkin suggests that conservatives are more apt to embrace labels than liberals because of the stigma attached to the L word. The fact is, over the decades, the center has slid to the right, and so has much of the mainstream media. But the center is in perpetual motion and may soon be in for another correction. Maybe this is the wrong argument, anyway. A week doesn't go by when I'm not admonished by a self-described conservative who loathes NPR, even as he swallows it with his morning coffee, every single day. There are thousands of news sources available with the twist of a dial, the click of a mouse. Change the channel. Find a news source you can trust most of the time. Reporters struggle regularly with their employers, their biases, and their consciences. They may be more liberal than America, but they reflect America nevertheless. The news media should be braver, purer, truer than the rest of us. But in a nation so deeply divided, any citizen, left, right, or center, who looks into the media mirror is bound to see something they despise.
There's a certain kind of story that calls for a few words from the man on the street. But for every time reporters call upon a local man or area resident, there are a bunch of responses you never hear, such as, please leave me alone, or get lost, or how much will you pay me? It happens, but if finding a willing voice is a problem for journalists, Greg Packer has provided the solution for more than a decade. Counting individual articles in the Nexus database since 1994, Packer has been quoted or photographed at least 16 times on separate occasions by the Associated Press, 14 times by Newsday, 13 times by the New York Daily News, and 12 times by the New York Post. And he's still counting. Reporter Amy O'Leary went on the rounds with the media's favorite, Vox Populi.
Greg Packer is probably the easiest person I'm ever going to interview.
You know, I always come up with an answer for everything, number one. And I always give everybody, you know, the respect and the time that they need. I make it very easy for them. I make it accessible.
Which on April 15th means waiting outside the post office just in case anybody wants a quote.
Yeah, well, tax day is a media event in itself. I try to get my taxes done early and save it for the last minute and throw it in the mail right here in New York on tax day.
Okay, see what he did just there? He slipped in the phrase, right here in New York on tax day. You've got the time, the place. It's a totally usable quote. Greg's specialty. He's out there every week. First, he checks the newspapers for concerts, sports games, parades, book signings, anywhere media trucks might be camped out. Then, he requests time off from his job as a highway worker on Long Island and shows up early, scanning the crowd for reporters. He gets quoted more than you might think, but for all this effort, Greg doesn't keep his clips. You see, for him, that's not the point. He wants a media job and what he calls a big money offer.
Doing commercials, maybe a radio show, very similar to WNYC and others for that matter. You know, something other than going up and down highway trucks, putting Sanders on, pumping out floods. You know, that's all fine and good because you have to do something. But there's something out there that's better for me.
All in all, Greg's racked up more than 100 appearances in the media. My favorite Greg Packer quote was something he said to the Daily News in 1998 about a Yankees game on Yom Kippur. Greg told them, "There's no way the Yankees will lose, but if they do, they'll certainly have something to atone for."
Do you go up to them?
Or what?
Or do they come up to you?
I think it's a little bit of both. A little bit of both. You know, call it a mutual understanding.
In the time I spent with Greg, the only journalist who approached him was me. Greg, however, approached two documentarians, three photographers, and a writer. He seeks them out to give them what they need. And Jeff Zilgit agrees. He's a sports columnist for USA Today, who Greg approached at two different sporting events in the span of 24 hours. Zilgit wound up using Greg in his column, but says it's rare that anyone approaches him to offer a quote. Overwhelmingly, he has to approach strangers.
I generally go to lots of sporting events. I have not one bit of problem walking into a, you know, sports locker room and asking a multi-million-dollar player a question. The part of the job I don't really care for is that man on the street quote. You know, it's sort of awkward because I just feel like I'm bothering people.
Last summer, things changed for Greg when he showed up in a flurry of articles about the Hillary Clinton book tour. Conservative columnist Ann Coulter noticed and called Greg the entire media's designated man on the street for all articles ever written.
You know, she's never met me. But you see, what Ann Coulter is forgetting is, whatever she's got to say about the media, I don't care. But to drag me into it, I think it's terrible.
Greg is a big fan of Hillary Clinton. She's nice to him, she remembers his name. But Greg's no left-wing stooge. He's for the Iraq War and definitely voting for Bush. Coulter may be wrong about Greg's politics, but she's right that journalists could be doing more. After her column exposed Greg's hobby, he was dealt another blow.
It's gotten to the point where the Associated Press, of all people, has had to issue a memo saying not to talk to me anymore. The memo said that the world is full of all kinds of interesting people.
The world is full of all kinds of interesting people. One of them is Greg Packer of Huntington, New York, who apparently lives to get his name on the AP wire and in other media.
This is Kristen Gasley, the deputy managing editor for National News at Associated Press. She wrote the memo.
I sent out a note to the staff noting that, you know, he had done nothing wrong, but that perhaps we were over-relying on him to provide insights into events.
The memo was the AP's equivalent of a bounced check taped to a convenience store window. Before Gasley sent it out, the wire service had used Greg repeatedly on topics like the millennium, St. Patrick's Day, the war in Iraq, and Christmas.
If there's any sense of journalistic outrage that he's pulling something on the media, he always said what his name was. When we called up these stories, they all say Greg Packer. That's who he is.
Hey, Greg.
Hey, how you doing?
You're first.
One of the first.
The next time I see Greg, he's sitting on a piece of cardboard outside the Virgin Megastore at Times Square. He and three teenage girls are the only ones camped out overnight. Greg tells me that he's probably slept outside this store 10 times for various concerts and signings, Tonight, it's to see Hanson. Sixteen hours later, the wait's paid off. Greg's at the foot of the stage, 5 feet away from the media pool. When he sees a guy with a video camera, Greg asks him to wait while he unrolls a fresh Hanson poster and poses with it.
What's this for, anyway?
It's a strange image. A video camera zooms in on a middle-aged man holding up a poster showing Zach, Taylor, and Isaac, while all around him, teenage girls are checking their lip gloss and adjusting their belly shirts. Ashley, the documentary filmmaker for Hanson, explains why he was drawn to Greg.
It's the big grin. That's what it is. Yeah. He just looks like a happy guy. Like, everybody else is kind of packed in here, and even though they're like, a lot of them, you know, are here to see Hanson, they're excited about that, they're not sitting here smiling. They're like, oh, I'm sweaty, I'm hot. He's smiling. He's got a big grin. Grins attract people. That's why I came up. That and the huge poster.
The guy has a point. Out of the teeming masses that swarm New York, over 100 journalists have selected Greg for a soundbite. But clearly, he doesn't represent a random sample. In fact, Greg's ubiquity undercuts the whole reason for remarks from the man on the street.
Maybe journalists should just stop doing man on the street
interviews. No, you can't do that. You need the man on the street quotes. You know, it's like the voice of the common person.
But often, as we heard, the common person doesn't like to give quotes, and reporters can't make them. So let's cut them some slack. Greg may not offer a statistically accurate sample of the common person, but maybe he does represent the ones who like to talk. For On the Media, I'm Amy O'Leary.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was directed by Katya Rogers and produced by Janine Price, Megan Ryan, and Tony Field, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Rob Christensen our engineer. We had help from Ann Kosseff and Mike Volo. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. And the National Endowment for the Arts. Support from the media comes from the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.